This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow is Chattanooga's runoff election for mayor and two city council seats. Tim Kelly and Kim White are vying to succeed two-term mayor Andy Burke in City Hall. Jenny Hill and Thomas Lee are competing for the city council seat in District 2, while in District 5, Dennis Clark and Isaiah Hester are in the runoff for that seat. Dr. Chris Acuff is Assistant Professor of Public Administration in the Department of Political Science and Public Service on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Compare and contrast between the two candidates and the presence that they have out there.
First and foremost, everyone's excited that it is coming to an end. candidates and campaigns and everyone else in the city. We've talked before, but I don't think the top two is a huge surprise given the dynamics of the race going into March. But the interesting thing we've seen in the last couple of weeks have been a lot of endorsements for both candidates. A lot of the former candidates for mayor have endorsed Tim Kelly. A lot of current city council members and county commissioners and others have endorsed Kim White. Both are kind of touting their support within the community, you know, their broad base of support, how they're connecting to neighbors and friends and supporters in every neighborhood. And everyone's kind of trying to kind of fight for this middle of moderate voters. We tout the nonpartisan nature of our race. Different sides have tried to paint the other candidate or campaign using a partisan lens, but both of them are trying to kind of create the sense of community and togetherness and how they're fighting for Chattanooga and every part of Chattanooga. So at this point, there are some distinguishing traits and characteristics between the two candidates in terms of their policies and what they're advocating for. But you can definitely tell just by the messaging that they're kind of trying to paint themselves in broad strokes and brushes and wanting the best for Chattanooga. So I think a lot of what distinguishes the two is, again, you can look at the endorsements, you can look at who's supporting them. Both of them are touting their fundraising numbers we just came out with this past week, raised a lot of money from a lot of diverse backgrounds and business interests and community interests. So it'll be an interesting time to see how this all comes to fruition.
Tim Kelly has received a number of endorsements from former rivals in the mayor's race, multiple African-American candidates. Kim White did very well in the first round, better than some people may have expected. And with a runoff, you're dealing with turnout. So it can be hard to parse where this might go.
Sure. Yeah. The one thing I will say I've been pleasantly surprised is that the turnout numbers in early voting reflected the general election. The general election early in absentee voting was over 12,000 people. We hit that with early voting the second round. So we'll see how many people show up on election day. But I think a lot of that's indicative of both of these are well-staffed, well-managed, well-funded campaigns. They're getting their people out. They're running ads. They're waving signs all over the place. And I think a lot of people are really excited to show up. The other interesting thing, is that several of the former mayoral candidates have endorsed Tim Kelly. I don't believe that any of them have endorsed Kim White. I could be mistaken on that. But for sure, the 3, 4, 5, and 6 in terms of finishers for the mayoral race have all endorsed Tim Kelly. So the nonpartisan nature of the race is something that both of them are touting. But when you look at their endorsements, it's safe to say, I think, that definitely more people who tend to lean Democratic are probably supporting Tim Kelly. People who tend to lean more conservative, again, some of the city council members and county commissioners have tended to support Kim White. And so, again, you can't necessarily parse this precisely with partisanship because, again, both of them are kind of touting their nonpartisan credentials and advocating for their sort of broad appeal to the electorate. But in terms of how these endorsements are looking, it's clear that a lot more Democrats and left-leaning moderates are tending to support Tim Kelly over Kim White. I think it's interesting that we've seen a lot of the African-American community come out and support Tim Kelly, starting with Russell Gilbert and Monty Brule as former candidates. They endorsed him pretty early. We saw Wade Hinton the other day come out and support him. Kim White has also gotten a couple of supporters from the African-American community. I mean, Warren Mackey and some others supported early, but they ended up switching. I don't know exactly how that's going to play out. I mean, I don't want to paint anybody with a broad brush and that Tim Kelly is going to get all the African-American support in town. Certainly not. But I think it is indicative maybe of how things are going and who the African-American community in Chattanooga sees as maybe their preferred candidate.
And even though this runoff is nonpartisan, as the first round was, still, when you're down to two candidates, you do see a few sharp elbows thrown.
Yeah, certainly. At this point, I think all the candidates especially these last two, have done 7,000 or 8,000 Zoom interviews and forums and things. But you could tell that some of the more recent ones, the ones coming down the stretch, were a little chippy. You know, they're trying to define themselves in terms of the nature of the race and how we talk about policy from a candidate's perspective. Everyone talks in these kind of broad strokes if they want the best for Chattanooga. They want to unite Chattanooga. They want to create good things for everyone. And so distinguishing yourself sometimes can be a little bit hard when your messaging is sort of surround these general broad statements. And so you've definitely seen a little bit of chippiness, I think, in a couple of these interviews and campaign forums, just in terms of, you know, maybe perceived weaknesses of each other, their backgrounds, their upbringing, their business backgrounds, you know, things like that. So maybe not too sharp elbows considering our current state of politics, but certainly for a local race where everybody kind of knows each other, you definitely saw them take a couple of shots at each other, I think.
And that's another thing, because it is a local race and everybody knows each other and has known each other for years and years and years. People know how to throw sharp elbows at one another, but there's an informal line to how far you can go, how chippy you want to be for a local race around here versus something we might see on a statewide or a national level.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the good thing about local races, right, is that there isn't as much partisanship. There isn't as much vitriol. There aren't as many things maybe that divide us here at the local level. So that has been one good feature of this race, is there really haven't been too many attack ads. There haven't been any terrible mailers out there or awful rumors about the candidates and things like that. So I think that's definitely a good feature of local races.
How does this compare with a few of the past mayoral cycles in Chattanooga that you have observed?
The hard thing is we're drawing from a small pool of comparable mayoral runoffs. The only one in recent history is in 2005 when now former Mayor Ron Littlefield ran off against Ann Coulter. And the interesting thing was that actually in the runoff, turnout was actually higher than the general election that year. So I'll be interested to see how turnout plays out this year compared to 2005. When you look at some of the council races and the mayoral race, the person who ended up leading actually doesn't usually fare that well. The person who led in March doesn't always go on to win. So there may be a couple of upsets, but if I were a betting person, and I'm not, at least in terms of politics, I would say that the people who had a lead in March most likely to probably maintain that lead. But at the same time, you figure if they didn't get 50% of the vote, there are a lot of people who voted for somebody else. Will those people be motivated to show up? Maybe. It certainly helps drive turnout that there's a mayor runoff compared to just these council races. But in terms of the council races, I think we mentioned this last time we talked, is that the most recent couple runoffs we've had in the council races, the person leading in March actually lost in most of those races. So when it comes to the district races, we'll have to see how those play out. And certainly everybody will be watching the mayoral race.
And recap for us the runoffs with the council races.
The runoffs this year will have District 2 and District 5. So obviously those are both open seats. So we sort of expected a runoff in at least one of the two or three. Rakita Dolly ended up winning outright in District 7. So that was the only other open seat. But Dennis Clark and Isaiah Hester going head to head in District 5. And then Jenny Hill and Thomas Lee in District 2. Jenny Hill got closer to 50% in her race. She was pretty close with the final turnout numbers. I think she got about 45% in her race. But Dennis Clark and Isaiah Hester were definitely a lot closer. They both finished in the 30s. That could be definitely one to watch when we're looking at the district races.
And without giving a prediction, when it comes to tomorrow night, what's the typical timeline for when we learn about the results as they come in?
The good thing is, compared to maybe the presidential race, is hopefully we should know fairly quickly. So polls will close at 8 o'clock. Usually we'll know probably within, say, 2 hours of the close of the polls. So certainly, hopefully, before everybody goes to bed that night, we'll know. Obviously, again, if any of these are super close, they'll definitely make sure and dot the I's and cross the T's, and we won't have the official results. But the other thing to consider is that the next mayor and council members are sworn in next Monday. So it's a pretty quick turnaround. Hopefully there are no challenges or nothing that comes down to one or two votes that they'll have to go back and recount these things. But we should know pretty quickly, especially with the mayoral candidates and their teams. Both have been preparing for the transition. Both have these plans to hit the ground running on day one. I'm sure Mayor Burke's staff and others have been helping them and more than willing to help sort of hand off the baton. So Chattanoogans definitely shouldn't worry about this transition. I think both of them, at least the mayoral candidates, are definitely well-qualified and well-staffed people, and they have a good team surrounding both of them. So hopefully we'll know soon, and then they can start focusing on the next steps for Chattanooga.
Not as quick of a transition as when they changed prime ministers in the UK, but pretty quick.
Right.
All right. Chris Acuff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marie Bostwick is the next author in the virtual Southbound Lecture Series from Southern Lit Alliance here in Chattanooga. Tomorrow at 6 p.m., she will appear on Zoom to talk about her latest novel, The Restoration of Celia Fairchild.
Marie, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us how you got into writing.
Well, you know, like a lot of writers, I never wasn't into writing. I was writing pretty much as soon as I could hold a pencil. But it wasn't until I was in my early 30s and I was on vacation and kind of almost wandered in practically by accident to a writer's workshop that my life really changed and I started taking my writing seriously. The facilitator pulled me aside at the end of the week and said, "So what have you published?" And of course, I'd never published anything. He, you know, urged me and in fact, helped me and became my mentor and got me to take writing in a more serious way and really look at honing my craft.
And then along the way, you have written 15 novels, 3 novellas, several have gone on to be bestsellers on the New York Times and USA Today lists. One of those novels from a little more than 5 years ago, The Second Sister,
yes,
was adapted into a Hallmark Hall of Fame film.
Yes, it was, which was really exciting and interesting. That movie was called, ended up being called Christmas Everlasting. I didn't know I'd written a Christmas book till they decided to make it into one. But it was very exciting and kind of a, you know, moment of history. It was the first time that Hallmark had done a Hall of Fame movie with a primarily multiracial cast. So Miss Patti LaBelle was in it. Tatiana Ali was in it. Dondre Whitfield, Dennis Haysbert. And I got to meet them all. So going to the set that day was really one of the best days of my life.
And the through line in all of your works is described as women's fiction. How do you describe it? How do you see it? Because of course, publishers and book reviewers and bestseller lists have to come up with a label that can just fit in a little space.
And isn't that a shame?
It is.
I'm not really a fan of the phrase women's fiction, specifically because there's nothing called men's fiction. It's pretty silly to separate it by gender. And yet I do understand why they do it. Most of my audience are women. But I think it's too bad because when we put that label on it, we kind of say to men who might enjoy this story, "Oh, go away now. Nothing to see here. This isn't for you." And that's not necessarily true. So I like to just call my books fiction because a good story is a good story.
And that brings us to The Restoration of Celia Fairchild. Tell us about Celia Fairchild.
Celia Fairchild is probably the character I have ever written. She is a syndicated advice columnist known as Dear Calpurnia. She is really good at her job. She is loaded with wisdom and insight. Sadly, she has very little insight into her own problems. And I loved that idea going into this because I honestly think that's kind of the human condition. We are so much better at recognizing other people's issues and flaws and the directions they should go than we are when we look at ourselves. So that's Celia. And through a series of events that I'm not going to go into too much, she leaves New York and she ends up going back to Charleston, South Carolina, where she grew up and where she has not been in 15 years. Really, what Celia wants more than anything is a family to replace the one that was taken from her in unusual circumstances many years before. And in this process, she's going to inherit a house from her aunt. So the title, The Restoration of Celia Fairchild, is really a play on words in so many places. You know, as you know, Charleston is at the forefront of the historic restoration movement. So while Celia is restoring this house, she's also undergoing a personal, a creative, a spiritual, and intellectual restoration as well.
What drew you to setting this character in a place like Charleston and in the South?
Well, I have lived all over the country. I currently live in Oregon, but I have lived in South Georgia, in Albany, Georgia at one point in my life. And that was when I made my first trips to Savannah and Charleston. And I was blown away. It is a visual feast. It is a sensory joy to walk down those streets. People have asked me, well, you're not from South Carolina. Why would you have set a book in Charleston? My question back to them is, if you're a writer and you have been to Charleston, how could you not want to set a book in Charleston?
This gets back to the confining labels.
Indeed.
You're quoted as saying that you could never have imagined that this book would become the way as it taps into your own experience, forcing you to pour more of yourself into the story than you had ever bargained for. It wasn't easy, but you believe it made Celia's story richer and better and more real. Tell us more about that.
Well, this book actually was written during a time when I was undergoing kind of a personal restoration. After having written 18 books in 13 years, I was kind of worn out. And I arranged the period of time in advance with my agent that I was going to get a break. I wanted a whole year to just kind of refill my creative well. And I did that. I went to a lot of museums. I read a lot of books. I'm a fiber artist. I played with a lot of fiber. I listened to music. I took long walks. I just nourished myself. But funny thing, writer's gonna write. So instead of taking a whole year off, after about 3 months, my agent called me up and she said, so are you writing? And it turned out that I already was. So, you know, Celia is undergoing her restoration and her doubts too about herself. And a lot of those reflect my own doubts. Certainly some of the ways she feels about her readership reflect the ways I have had struggles being with my readership. You know, if you're going to be a celebrity, be a writer, because we're the celebrities nobody knows. And yet there is a responsibility to being a public person and there's a weight to it sometimes. And Celia struggles with that. I struggle with that. Celia also has a complicated relationship with her father. She loves him, but it's difficult. I had a similar relationship with my dad. My dad died during the writing of this book. And so he died in a time when we were not able to go through the rituals that one needs to have closure. So writing this book in a way was my way of helping myself to find that closure in that relationship with my dad, who I love very much, but that parent-child bond, it can be tricky sometimes.
What do you hope people take away from this novel? Coming out at this time, after the year that we have had.
So many people have said to me, yo, this is the right book for now. But, you know, I've been writing this kind of book for a very long time. But I do think there's something to that. And I do think we need to be kind to ourselves and kind to other people as well. I think we need to take those breaks. And in some sense, this has been a hard year, but I also think that there will be a whole lot of people that come out of it that are taking different directions in their lives because we were forced to stop. We were forced to reflect whether we wanted to or not. I bet some great art will have been created during this time, but I think a lot of people are going to look at what they were doing before and say, you know what? I don't want to do my life like that again. My new normal is going to be a new direction.
And that's what the mission of the Southern Lit Alliance is all about. Why, no doubt, they were drawn to you and to this particular book, how they have focused on literature in the South, about the South, and devoted to lifelong learning. And through literature, offering to people ways to think about new directions and inspire them to pursue those new directions. And that's why you're part of this virtual Southbound lecture series. For more information about Southern Lit Alliance, including to participate in this virtual talk that you will be giving, they can go to southernlitalliance.org. For people who want to keep up with all that you do, where can they go online?
MarieBostwick.com. So my books are there. And I have a lifestyle blog that I write called Fiercely Marie, and I post there about twice a week. That's just something I do for fun because I'm a big believer that there is great pleasure to be had in the small moments of life. So I try to share the things that bring that joy to me in my life with my readers. But of course, I've got all my books there too.
Well, Marie, thank you for taking a few small moments with us here and taking a few small moments through Southern Lit Alliance with the virtual Southbound lecture series.
I'm looking forward to talking with people.
The Four Bridges Arts Festival, which celebrates the visual arts here in Chattanooga, returns as a live event this year. A preview party will be held Friday, and the festival runs Saturday and Sunday, all at the First Horizon Pavilion. Sarah Moore is the festival's director. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ray. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here, and glad to hear that Four Bridges is going to be in person again.
We are thrilled that Four Bridges is coming back live. Last year was difficult. We had to postpone and then take it to a virtual platform in the fall last year. And with the vaccinations and everything kind of calming down here locally a little bit, we feel really comfortable about bringing the event back live. We'll have a few adjustments to make with COVID precautions, but the event is going to look pretty similar to most folks who come down to join us.
How recent did you decide to make it live this time? Because as you know so well, there are so many moving parts for an event such as this, whether it's virtual or live or a hybrid.
Well, we wanted to get through the sort of holiday surge of COVID, the Christmas surge, because that was sort of the peak of everything here. We wanted to get through that and see how quickly things calmed down. And then once the vaccine rolled out in January or end of December or January, and it began moving very quickly, we started feeling very comfortable sort of end of January, beginning of February with moving forward as planned and getting everything ready for April.
So what will we see this year?
We've shrunk our number of artists down a little bit, which will help us with spacing and keeping everything a little more social distanced. But we'll have about 120 artists this year, everything from ceramics to jewelry to painting to woodwork and everything in between. At all price ranges, we try to keep everything priced from about $35 up to several thousand. So there's a little something for everyone to come enjoy. But it's a feast for the eyes. There's a little something for everybody to enjoy, whatever your preferences are. And so we hope everybody comes out.
And it's a showcase for art created right here in the Chattanooga area.
Yes, we have lots of local artists participating, but there's also artists from around the country. We've got artists from as far away as California and North Dakota coming. We've got lots of local artists participating. I think there's just over a dozen local artists participating this year, plus our five emerging artists who have never had a gallery show or been in a festival before, and they come in our emerging artist program and get a free booth space, and we're delighted to showcase them this year with the help of First Horizon Bank.
Is there any of the art that is influenced by the year that we have all just lived?
I'm sure that there will be. I know Jamie Barks is one of our local artists. She's a painter. She has been titling a lot of her most recent works, a lot of which are influenced by her jaunts out hiking in the woods. She's titled a lot of them with references to being quarantined and being alone and being lonely and what a difficult year 2020 has been. And so I think you'll see quite a bit of that referenced in a lot of people's work.
At the same time, there will be plenty of art there to inspire the imagination and to nourish the soul above and beyond the events of the past year.
Absolutely. The artists are delighted to have an event to come to. They are thrilled to be out and about. And so this is a very joyous event for them. Many of them, this will be their first live event between 12 and 15 months. Lots of them make their living doing festivals like this around the country. And this is the first one they've been able to come back to. And so it's a really big deal. And they are so excited to be here.
It's been a tough time for so many artists because of those conditions.
It has. It's been really, really tough. We really tried to stick things out last year and make sure that they knew that we were holding their booth fees that they'd already paid us for last year's festival and holding on to those and really looking forward to getting done whatever we could get done, making the virtual event so that they had something to put out there online. But we have really been keeping close communication with our artists so that they know that we're really committed to making this event happen, making sure it happens safely, making sure they're safe and cared for, but making sure that it's a good event.
And there's an app.
We have an app. We started the app last year for the virtual event in September, and we're carrying it over. It will replace what is usually our printed program guide this year, but it has a full list of all the artists, links to their artwork, information about our sponsors and our jurors and all of that, information about the whole festival. But you can find it on the Google Play and Apple App Stores. Just search Four Bridges Arts Festival.
And right now, it is all about the festival. But as we emerge from this pandemic, you folks at AVA have some more things in mind for later this year.
Absolutely. So we have already our full 2021 gallery schedule worked out for AVA. So we have a full slate of gallery shows lined up for 2021. Those rotate about every 6 weeks. There's one closing at the end of this week, and we'll open up a new one after Four Bridges. And we have student shows in our education gallery all year, in addition to those regular shows. We are also looking at the possibility of hosting a locals-only art festival, smaller one-day show in October. So stay tuned for more information about that.
And for details about the festival and to keep up on everything happening at AVA, where can people go online?
You can go to our website. The main website is avarts.org, or you can go to fourbridgesartsfestival.org. to find out more specifically just about the festival. And the festival is happening for the public. It's next Saturday and Sunday, April 17th and 18th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. $5 for adults and free for kids under 18.
All right. Sarah, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ray. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots from the Isis Theater in Asheville. This is Lazy Birds, recorded before a limited audience in the theater. Both the band and the people watching clearly happy to be there after so long. The band, from North Carolina, is James Brown on drums, Asher Hill playing bass, Brad Pope plays guitar, and Jay Brown is the singer, guitar player, and he also plays harmonica. From the Mountain Spirit Acoustic Series Facebook page, this is Lazy Birds. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, y'all. Do an original tune here. I hope you'll hear some Doc Watson influence in this song. This is called The Backroads Boogie. Just the other day, she said, "Sweet daddy, I'm here all alone." She might have said more, but I done dropped the phone and did the back roads boogie. such an easy ride. The back roads boogie boogie down the countryside. It's rush hour traffic, quarter past five. A farmer on the tracks was letting a little boy drive. I slam on the brakes and I stop with some screeches. See a rooster stand, I gotta stop and get some peaches. Doing the back roads boogie, such an easy ride. Back roads boogie, boogie down the countryside. On the interstate, you just can't win. With all the big, big rigs pinning you in. But the back roads boogie, just my style. Open it up down the country miles and do the back roads boogie. Such an easy ride. The back roads boogie, boogie down the countryside.
Thank you.
You want to switch to the leg? Look at you. Let's do Honeysuckle, then switch over to the.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to learn a new song.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Look, folks, just looked at the clock and we're all almost playing overtime. We really appreciate y'all being here. Scott, can we play another short song? Or okay. Thank you all so much. I can't tell you what a joy it is to play for such a wonderful live audience, or any live audience, really, but especially this wonderful one, and to play in not only a venue, but the best venue, and the great staff. And thank you so much to everybody, Scott, and the great sound crew here. Thank y'all.
don't you wanna go? I'm going to some place where I've never been before. I'm gone where the water tastes like wine. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. We can jump in the water and stay drunk all the time. I'm gone and be gone where I'm gonna go today now. Just exactly where we're going, I cannot say it. We might even leave the USA. There's a brand new game, Lord, but somebody's gotta play. No use in you running or screaming and crying when you got a home as long as I got
Lazy Birds in the Isis Theatre on April 2nd. The full show with video is on the Mountain Spirit Acoustic Series Facebook page on listener-supported public radio. This is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.